This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Coming up, you've likely heard reports that California's snowpack is at its lowest level in recorded history. But it's not the only state in the West experiencing drought conditions. We'll talk about that a little bit later. But first, you may have heard of oxytocin, the so-called love hormone that is released in large amounts during childbirth, breastfeeding, whatever. It's supposed to make you bond. It's also linked to trust, generosity, other good things. But a new study out in the journal Science this week suggests that we may actually have that chemical link with dogs. All you dog lovers, listen up. Why is that dog staring at you so nicely? We're going to talk about it. Rachel Feltman, she runs the Speaking of Science blog at Washington Post. She joins us here in our New York studios. Welcome back, Rachel.
Hi, thanks for having me again.
Dogs and oxytocin.
Right. So oxytocin is this really cool chemical that we don't totally understand yet. It's not really the love hormone. It actually might make people do some pretty not great things sometimes, but it does have something to do with bonding. It definitely is important for mother-child bonding, and it also gives us a better ability to respond to social cues. And there was a study this week that found that when dog owners and dogs gaze into each other's eyes, they have this oxytocin feedback loop. They both get boosts of oxytocin. And what's interesting is that when they did the same test on wolves who were also raised as domestic pets, the wolves did not get the same boost. So it seems like it's something dogs developed.
So when your dog is giving you that lovingly look, it really is giving you that look.
Yeah, you're really bonding and having some kind of social chemistry that doesn't usually happen between two different species.
Wow. Okay. The dog lovers are going to love that. What's second on your list?
Second on my list is some space news. So the Rosetta Orbiter and its lander, Philae, brought back some information on the magnetism of the comet they're studying. And it was, I think the way the researchers put it, was remarkably non-magnetic. It has something like 1/1000th the magnetic field of Earth.
Surprising?
Well, not so much surprising, but it kind of confirms that magnetism wasn't very important for bringing together the particles that formed this comet, which some researchers thought magnetism was important. What's cool about this one that I love is that, as you probably know, when the Philae lander landed on the comet, it had a very bumpy landing.
It bounced really high.
Yeah, it bounced a couple times, and that was really bad for the lander because it ended up in a dark crater and lost power. May turn on sometime in the next couple months as the comet gets closer to the sun, but we don't know. But because of those bounces, the researchers were actually able to get more information on the magnetic field because they got it from multiple points and they got it as it rose and fell. So they were actually able to come to stronger conclusions with this one particular study because the Philae lander bounced.
Serendipity in action.
Absolutely.
Yeah, if they hadn't bounced, I wouldn't have known that.
Exactly.
About that. Next thing on your list.
So New Horizons is another space robot, and it's speeding towards Pluto right now. It's going about 1 million miles a day. And in July, it's going to make a close flyby with Pluto, going to give us our best ever look at the planet, the dwarf planet. And this week, it released its first color images of Pluto and its moon Charon. Pluto and Charon are really cool. They're tidally locked with each other, so they face each other and spin around this fixed point. They're almost more like a binary planet system than like a moon and a planet. So we really want to learn more about them. And the picture is very blurry. They pretty much just look like two points of light. But what's exciting is that it's an indication of what's to come. Right now, if the Earth was at the resolution that's in these pictures, we wouldn't be able to make out continents. By the time we make the closest flyby in July, we'll have a resolution like a flyover map of Manhattan where you can make out Central Park.
That close?
Yes.
Wow.
So we're going from knowing really nothing when it comes down to it about this planet and its moons to having incredible resolution.
Hope we can see the boat basin. Sorry about that. It's Central Park. Next on your list.
Okay, so researchers at MIT developed this very strange digital camera. The video isn't impressive, but what is that the camera is completely self-powered. And the way they did that is that every camera in the image sensor, the pixels have photodiodes, which absorb light, convert them to electrical signals, and the intensity of those electrical signals helps it interpret an image out of the light being shown on it. But photovoltaic cells in solar panels do the same thing, except they take that energy and turn it directly into electricity. So they decided to make photodiodes that could both absorb the light to make the picture and absorb it to harness the energy. So it's kind of constantly powering itself. And you can also use it to power devices when you're not taking pictures.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, I know you have something about knuckle cracking.
I do. I have something about knuckle cracking. So a bunch of researchers decided that it was time to get some knuckles in an MRI and figure out what actually makes that sound. In like the 40s, there was a study saying it's a fluid bubble that forms near knuckles. The sound is when it forms. Then in the 70s, a bunch of researchers said, no, the sound is when the bubble bursts. But this study says it is when the bubble forms.
It is. We've solved that.
Well, we'll see. It was, you know, it was a sample size of one.
Oh, yeah.
Even though they used all 10 fingers.
How many knuckles can you get in there at once?
So they'll have to try to repeat it. And they're going to try to use some high-tech sound equipment to really make sure that the sound is coming at the moment these bubbles form.
There were a couple. Right. That was it. That's it for the show. Yeah. That's all the knuckles I've got. Thank you, Rachel. Always good to have you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Rachel Feltman. She runs the Speaking of Science blog at the Washington Post. Next up, time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. This week's topic, new maps and polling data that show Americans are paying attention to renewable energies and regulating CO2. Anthony Leiserwitz is director of the Yale Project on Climate Change Communications at Yale in New Haven. He joins us from WNPR. Welcome back.
Hi, Ira. Great to be with you.
Let's play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Good thing.
Good thing. Well, first of all, we were able to develop a new statistical model that allows us to estimate public understanding of climate change for all 50 states, all 435 congressional districts, and all the way down to all 3,000 counties in America. So it's like we've been given a microscope. So for the very first time, we can see the tremendous diversity and patterns going around within or below the national surface of, say, national surveys and polls. And one of the good things that we find there is that despite the diversity of the country, and it is quite diverse, you do still see that a majority of Americans in every part of the country, every state, every congressional district, and most of the counties in the country believe that climate change is happening. So that is good, ranging from a high of 72% in New York State down to a low of 54% in West Virginia.
And you have an interactive map there that's quite interesting on the website. You can just mouse over all these different places and see that change.
That's right. So when we published this, we decided to create an interactive map called Yale Climate Opinion Maps, and anyone can come and visit and try to see what does the public understand about this issue right in your own backyard.
And the bad thing?
Well, a number of bad things. One in particular is Americans still have no idea that most scientists have agreed and are convinced, based upon the evidence accumulated over many, many years, that climate change, in fact, is happening and human-caused. We see that nationally, only about half of Americans understand that, and it's as low as 42% in the state of Wyoming. So there's a lot of misunderstanding about even the basic scientific consensus that this is actually a real problem.
So, and that goes, I mean, you notice on the map that goes all across the country that people don't know that scientists have a consensus on this.
That's right.
Wow. Why is that, do you think?
Why is that? Great. So, I mean, there's a number of things. One is that the media does play some role here. So for many years, the media loves to have conflicting viewpoints. You know, it's been called false balance. So you put up a climate scientist up against another person who denies that climate change is real or human caused or a serious problem. And so for most viewers at home, they look at that and they say, well, there's one viewpoint versus another viewpoint. It looks like scientists are still arguing. It's a 50-50 split. And so that's maybe appropriate in a political debate between Democrats and Republicans. It's not appropriate when you're looking at the conclusions of established science, where it's well over 97% of scientists who are convinced that climate change is happening.
Did you see that John Oliver on his program with Bill
Nye? That's
right. Even that out in one episode?
That's right. That was brilliant. The other, of course, is recognize that there's been a well-funded and well-organized disinformation campaign that's basically taken an approach straight out of the tobacco wars in the secret documents released on the tobacco companies that doubt is our product. If we can keep people thinking that the experts are still arguing about whether smoking is bad for your health, they'll keep smoking. And in fact, that's exactly what they did for decades. That exact same strategy is now being used and has been used for years in the climate debate, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Anything to do about that?
Scientists bear some responsibility here, too. Scientists aren't very good communicators in general, and we aren't very active about making sure people understand the things that we all understand. I mean, look, as a scientist, we get all of our credit and, you know, the approval of our peers for being at the cutting edge, for being at the unanswered questions, right? We don't spend a whole lot of time trying to review the things that everybody in the field already accepts. And so that's partly our fault. We need to do a much better job of helping Americans understand here's what we all know. And it's some of just the basics. It's real, and it's human caused, and it's bad.
Mm-hmm. And you've documented it there on your website. What is the website for that great graph that you have?
So you can just come to environment.yale.edu/climate, and you'll find them.
Anthony, thanks again for taking time to be with us today.
Sure. Thanks, Ryer.
Anthony Leiserwitz is director of the Yale Project on Climate Change Communication at Yale University in New Haven. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the drought in California. If you're out there in California listening, you know. But we're going to talk about it with the rest of the country and talk about how widespread it is all out the Southwest. Give us a call if you'd like to talk about it, 844-724-8255. You can tweet us at SciFry. Tell us what you're seeing, 844-724-8255. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. How do you predict how much California is going to have, how much rain, how much water it's going to have in a given year? Well, you go to straight to the source, right up there in the mountains, and you look at the snow. Surveyors trudge out into the Sierra Nevada mountains with a metal measuring tubes that they plunge into the snowpack. And one of those people is Frank Gehrke, who's featured in our new video series, The Macroscope, now up on sciencefriday.com.
Today was very grim. We had less than 1 inch of snow water equivalent at this location.
It turns out that this year the snowpack in the Sierra Nevadas is only 40% of what it was last year. And last year, that was one of the driest years on record. But California is not alone. Many states in the western U.S. are facing a future of less water and warmer temperatures. Joining me now to discuss the future of water in the West are B. Lynn Ingram. She's author of the book, The West Without Water, and she's a professor of Earth and Planetary Science, University of California at Berkeley. Welcome to Science Friday.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Tom Painter, he's principal investigator at NASA's Airborne Snow Observatory. He joins us from JPL in Pasadena, California. Welcome to Science Friday.
Good to be on your program.
You're welcome. Our number is 844-724-8255. If you are experiencing the drought firsthand, give us a call. You can also tweet us at SciFry, 844-724-8255. Tom, how important is the snow to California's water supply?
Well, the snowfall in each year represents about 70% of the annual precipitation. Another way of thinking about this is if you cut the mountains down in California completely, you wouldn't have very much precipitation here. So it's absolutely key to the water supply.
Mm-hmm. And how much, in the survey that you're doing, how much snow is there left and how many years' worth of supply is up there?
Well, so The way that we've you spoke about Frank Gehrke, and he's the chief of the California Cooperative Snow Surveys, where they plunge the snow tubes into the snowpack once a month. They also have snow pillows, which are like water beds that weigh how much snow there is. What we're doing now with this program, the Airborne Snow Observatory, is to map the entire mountain snowpack. So we use a laser system that allows us to know the snow depth, and we know it wall to wall. So instead of these numbers of what's the rough percentage of normal, instead we can actually give you what you want, which is how much water is there up in the snowpack. Fortunately or unfortunately, we had 2014 last year as one of the worst years on record, and therefore we can compare against that, and that's where your number, the 40%, came from. I flew in the Airborne Snow Observatory on Wednesday, and we flew the Tuolumne River Basin and the Merced River Basin in the Central Sierra, and it looked to me like it usually looks after an early October snowfall. There actually is very little snow remaining up there to be coming down into the reservoirs.
So you couldn't get? Could you give me an estimate? How many years worth, or is it one season, or is it half? When will it run out? I guess.
Oh,
when I'm asking.
Well, so each year the snowpack melts off. There are a few glaciers that remain, but this is a seasonal snowpack. So the snow falls there, then it melts, and it flows down into the reservoirs, or it flows down into the river. And so it's not multiple years. The years of storage is what goes into the reservoirs. That's why we have the reservoirs, is to be able to hold on to that water that otherwise rushes off into the rivers than would have rushed off into the ocean. What remains, our best understanding of how much, for instance, in the Tuolumne River Basin, the average peak snow water equivalent, so the total amount of water, is about 660,000 acre feet.
Well,
so by comparison,
I was looking for some easily measurable thing, but you're not going to be able to give me one. I can see that.
Well, let me just give you a comparison. So what we have right now is about 50,000 acre feet.
Wow, that's not much.
Yeah, so not much left to go into the reservoir.
Lynn Ingram, how long has this been going on in California, this current drought?
Well, I mean, we're in our fourth year of the current drought, but if you actually could think that we're in the 15th year, because in California and the entire West, we've had lower than average precipitation and runoff for, 13 out of the last 15 years or something. So some are arguing that we're actually in a mega drought right now. I mean, that's lasted 15 years. Mm-hmm. So I think it's more severe than just thinking of this just a 3-year window.
When does a mega drought turn into something permanent, like a real climate change where you have a desert now, where you had forests and rainwater and stuff?
Well, if you look over the history over the last hundreds to thousands of years, you see that climate is extremely variable in California and the West. And it goes from maybe a decade or longer of drier conditions alternating with wetter conditions. So it usually just varies. The problem now is that we're adding, on top of the natural variability, we're adding global warming, and in this part of the world, it's predicted to get drier with fewer winter storms and less snowpack, more evaporation, drier soils. So that's where we're looking at, maybe a more permanent shift in the climate.
Tom, California is not the only Western state in dire straits.
That's right.
Is it?
Tell
us about the rest of them.
Yeah. So in the Colorado River Basin, in particular the Upper Colorado, which runs from Utah, Wyoming, Colorado, and New Mexico, as Lynn indicated, those have been in drought arguably since 1999. Not as conspicuous and as intense a drought as 2014 and 15 in California, but the accumulation of this drought is then the depletion of those big reservoirs in the Colorado River Basin, Lake Powell and Lake Mead. Mm-hmm. The Colorado River Basin also has about 4.5 years of annual flow storage, which allows it to be relatively well buffered against drought compared to California, which has about a year and a half of annual runoff storage in its mountain reservoirs. However, as Lynn indicated, we've been now 15 years in drought, and we're seeing the lake levels of both of those big reservoirs dropping, such that the state of Nevada is drilling up underneath Lake Mead to try to access that water in case in Lake Mead it drops below the intakes.
Hmm. We have some folks who are going to share with us some of their drought experience. Our number 844-724-8255. Let's go to the phones to Lisa in Richland, Oregon. Hi, Lisa.
Hello. How are you doing?
Fine. How are you?
Good, yes. My husband and I recently drove through the Rocky Mountains across Telluride and then all the way out to Seattle, Washington. I could not believe the lack of snow. We were just in shock. And, of course, out here in Oregon, near the wilderness areas, Hell's Canyon, whatnot, no snow. It's very frightening. Do scientists have a projection of the jet stream? Is it affecting the snowpack? And do we have a projection over the next decade for that?
Oh, the good questions. Tom, Lynn, is there an abnormal weather pattern that's set up to make it dry up there all the time? Is something locked in?
Not all the time, necessarily, but what we have been in, certainly in the last few years, we've had what's been coined the ridiculously resistant ridge, and we've had this high-pressure system sitting right on the west coast of California, which bumps the jet stream around and has made for those precipitation events on the east coast and has kept us very, very dry. There's some indication right now from some of the climatologists that El Nino may be shaping up, and so we could run into a very heavy precipitation year next year. And the last big drought that we had, worst year, was in California, was 1976-77. That was followed by two of the wettest years on record. So it isn't always necessarily that we lapse into these longer droughts. But as Lynn indicated, 15 years of drought is not unprecedented in the paleo record. The paleo record going back 2000 shows at times we run 30, 50, and even 80-year droughts, have not planned for.
I have a tweet from Owen's dad. It says, California is a desert-like ecosystem. Shouldn't the population explosion in the state's largest cities be responsible for restrictions? Population.
Well, I mean, it's true. Our population has really exploded, probably to greater than really the region can support. But 80% of our developed water goes toward agriculture, with only 20% going toward urban uses. So, I mean, we can and are going to start limiting our water use and so forth. But I think a lot of it also should, at the agricultural industry really needs to start looking at it, increasing efficiency and which crops it's growing and so on.
I want to bring in Mike Marcus. He's general manager of the Orange County Water District that's based in Fountain Valley, California. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you, Ira. Glad to be here.
You have an effort to recycle wastewater in Orange County as a direct reaction to the drought. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, certainly. Our board actually in the early 90s, after we were coming out of another drought, decided to develop this very, very large recycled water project. And what we do is we take wastewater from the sanitation district to our next door neighbors. So anything that comes in the sewer goes through the sanitation district first. They treat it to a level whereby you can safely discharge it into the ocean. But instead of discharging it into the ocean or considering it a waste, we consider it a resource. So we intercept that water, and then we run it through an advanced water purification process, which consists of microfiltration, reverse osmosis, and then UV light with hydrogen peroxide. By the time we've gotten through that process, we've taken this wastewater and treated it to near distilled water quality. We then take that water, put it back into our groundwater basin, where it then becomes a source of potable supply for the county. And this facility is very significant. It's 70 million gallons per day. It's the world's largest indirect potable reuse project.
Huh, and is it directly applicable to other municipalities?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, what we're seeing here, particularly in the state of California, is other cities looking to replicate what we've done. City of San Diego, City of Los Angeles up in the Bay Area, Santa Clara Valley Water District has put in a 8 million gallon similar type project. So we're seeing more and more agencies going to this type of technology and use of water.
This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International, talking about the drought in out west in California and other states. Do people do they also conserve water in your hometown? And because that seems to be one of the biggest problems. And I'm watching all the tweets coming in, people saying no one's paying attention. They're not conserving water unless they're forced to do that.
Well, actually, it's interesting, Ira, because water demands in Southern California have not really increased over the last 20 years, even with increasing population. So what we have done as far as water conservation or water use efficiency is done really a good job of installing low-flow toilets, low-flow shower heads in the house, energy-efficient washers, and use that as a means of kind of reducing the amount of water that we use inside the house. Where we probably could do a better job is our usage outside the house, as far as watering our lawns and those types of outside usages. But the governor just last week declared that there was going to be a mandatory 25% reduction in water usage that has to be implemented within the next year.
Hmm. What about the bottled water industry? Some of the major bottlers have come under attack for using up a lot of the water.
Well, yeah, we, you know, that's kind of a pet peeve of ours is, you know, we think that people should be using more of the water that we make available, that our retail agencies make available to them. It's very, very costly consuming the bottled water when people may not realize that the water that's delivered to their homes is absolutely perfectly safe and probably should be the primary use of consumption.
Lynn Ingram, any final thoughts on where this is all headed and if there's anything to do about it?
Well, I mean, I just want to make the point, one, that the 20th century, when we built up all our water developments, dams and aqueducts, was a relatively wet century when viewed from the long term. And, you know, this is when all our population growth occurred. And we can't assume, in fact, it's very unlikely that we'll go back to that higher level of precipitation. So we really need to start shifting to longer-term mitigation strategies like they're doing in Orange County, and I don't that more of the state and the entire West really needs to, you know, start increasing our resilience for future water scarcity, because I think that's what we're going to be living with for a long time.
Well, what about projects like desalination? Is that a viable option? Anybody?
Yeah, this is Mike. Absolutely. When we talk about water resources in California, you know, our messaging typically is we need to conserve first. We need to conserve as much as we can. Then we need to recycle. There's still a tremendous opportunity to do that. And then part of the water portfolio in the future will have to be seawater desalination. And it is a viable option. Right now there's a project being constructed in Carlsbad, California, which is about halfway between Los Angeles and San Diego. It's a 50 million gallon per day facility, and it's scheduled to go online at the end of this year.
But you have to figure out, what do you do with all that salt and all those minerals that are in the ocean once you take
them out? Well, we do have the technology to remove them and safely remove them. I mean, this has been done for decades in the Middle East as a source of supply for water in that area.
Is it pricey? Is it too pricey? Can you actually do it?
Right now, the economics are what's hindering its use. But as we see imported water, water that we here in Southern California bring from either the Colorado River or Northern California, as that becomes less and less reliable, we need to look for more local water supply reliability. And that's why water recycling and perhaps seawater desalination will be important components moving into the future.
All right, Mike Marcus, General Manager of Orange County Water District, Ingram, author of the book, The West Without Water. Tom Painter, principal investigator at NASA's Airborne Snow Observatory. Thank you all for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you, Ira.
Thank you.
You're welcome. A good weekend. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about the microbiome. One that we haven't talked about for a while, an unusual one. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. You know, we love the microbiome here at Science Friday. We talk about it as much as we can. It's that community of bacteria that lives on and in our bodies and plays an important role in our health. But there is a lot in Western lifestyles, antimicrobial soap, chlorinated water, cesarean childbirth, that cuts down on these microbial communities. So what would the microbiome look like in a group of people that had never experienced any of these things? Maria Gloria Dominguez-Bello and colleagues chronicled the microbiome of people living in an isolated village in the Venezuelan Amazon that had no documented previous contact with Western people. And this is what's really interesting about this, is that they found that the microbiome of these people, the Yanomami, contained the highest levels of bacterial diversity ever reported in a human group, the highest levels. And some of the bacteria they studied carry genes that code for antibiotic resistance, even though the people there had never any exposure to commercial antibiotics. How is all of that possible? Maria Gloria Dominguez-Bello is an associate professor in the Department of Medicine at NYU School of Medicine. She is author of a paper on the research, appearing this week in the journal Science Advances. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me here.
Well, this is such an interesting discovery you made. Tell us about these people themselves. Where do they live? How did you contact them?
So these are one of the most remote tribes or traditional Amerindian peoples, and they live in faraway places. In Venezuela in particular, they live in the south, which is much pristine and not developed, just because there is not oil there, thanks God. Venezuela has the oil more in the northern side, so they have protected the Amazon for many decades now. And to go to these very remote places, you need permission from the government, and it's very hard to get there if you don't have a helicopter. So there is no tourism. There are some missions, mostly Catholic, but very, very little impact. And I'm originally Venezuelan, and I have been working in the Amazon during the 14 years I worked in Caracas, and I have a very good team of scientists there, some of which work in the Amazonian Institute of Research called the CAISET. And through them, we knew that the militaries had spotted village in the jungle.
I see. How different is their microbiome from that of a Westerner?
So we found in them an unprecedented high diversity, about 25% to 30% above the very high diversity that we had already observed in transculturated Amerindians, also from the Amazon, but villages that were already in contact with the health services, for example.
Mm-hmm. And were there just exotic strains of bacteria, or were they common ones we have seen everywhere else?
So we found in them more unknown bacteria than what we find in our samples. We still have unknown bacteria in U.S. microbiome, but they had a lot more. But notably, we can see of the known bacteria which one we can observe disappearing in the gradient of urbanization. So we now have them in one extreme, the uncontacted, then we have traditional societies that have been contacted but live in a very traditional ways and don't live with on market economies. They provide their own foods, but they are more agriculturalist and have access to vaccines and antibiotics. And we are in the other extreme, highly exposed to antibiotics and C-sections and soaps and canned and preserved food and processed food. And so we are in the impacted extreme. And we can see what bacteria are disappearing.
Mm-hmm. And now some of the bacteria in the samples you tested carry genes for antibiotic resistance, even though these people have presumably never encountered a modern antibiotic.
Yeah, that's correct. So in addition to being very surprised for the extremely high diversity, we also were surprised that after having cultured their bacteria and observing that they were all sensitive to antibiotics, we saw no resistance in the lab. However, when we sequenced the genome of these bacteria, they do carry antibiotic resistance genes, but they are off. They are silenced. And that was very surprising, because why would they do that? What's the function of those genes? We still don't know. They may be playing other functions, degrading other xenobiotic compounds, other toxins, or who knows? We still don't understand that result.
Could there be natural antibiotics in the soil or in the jungle that we don't know about?
Sure, the soil is probably the major source of antibiotics. But why do they have them silenced is what we don't understand. Why would the bacteria be sensitive to antibiotics when they have the arsenal, the genomic arsenal? What we think is these genes may be either have very low cost to carry, and they are like an arsenal kept for when it's necessary. And we also think that if we expose those bacteria now to antibiotics, the antibiotic resistance will bloom. And that's something we plan to do experiments in the lab.
So that's the next thing. Are you finished studying these folks out there? Or are you going
back?
Well,
I would love to go back to the very same village now that the medical doctors have vaccinated and introduced antibiotics, because that's a state policy. Venezuela contacted people, and they try to go at least once a year. That's not always the case, but it's a natural experiment by which we can understand what happens once you introduce synthetic antibiotics in a naive population.
Hmm. Well, thank you very much for sharing that with us, and good luck. We wish you good luck in getting back there.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me there.
You're welcome. Maria Gloria Dominguez Bello, Associate Professor in the Department of Medicine at the NYU School of Medicine. When you look up at the sky at night, you can spot the stars and the planets, maybe even a comet if you're lucky. But that's only 4% of the entire universe. What you can't see is the invisible dark stuff, the dark matter, the glue that keeps all of that stuff together. And scientists know that dark matter is out there. But what is it? How does it interact? We're still in the dark about all of that stuff. But a group of researchers looking at the collisions of four galaxies discovered some clues that may shed some light on the dark stuff. The study was published this week in the journal Monthly Notices of the Royal Astronomical Society. Richard Massey is the lead author on that study. He's an astrophysicist at the Institute for Computational Cosmology at Durham University in Durham, England. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Why is dark matter described as dark? What makes it invisible?
It doesn't actually care about most of the rest of the universe. It doesn't really interact with us. It's kind of weird that it's the most common stuff, and yet it doesn't sort of feel everything else around it. It doesn't shine, which is why it's called dark matter. It doesn't sort of feel any of the normal forces that we feel. So, for example, when you run into a wall, you hit it and bump off it, and it hurts. Whereas if dark matter runs into a wall, then it just carries on straight through. So it's kind of this odd stuff. It's the most common stuff in the universe, but it doesn't care about the rest of us.
And we don't know what it is.
No, it's really a big embarrassment, to be honest, that we don't know what the most common stuff in the universe is. Everything that science has sort of ever studied has been the tiny little tip of the iceberg.
Right. It's just most of it makes up the universe, and we don't know what it is. Your paper out this week, though, says that the dark matter may not be completely dark. You used Hubble images. Explain that to us.
So we want to figure out what on earth this stuff is, and whether it is completely inert, which is what the theories up till now have been saying. That they say that it has gravity, which is great for us. Like you say, it's this glue. Its gravitational attraction holds things together. But we want to figure out what else does it do, and that really defines what dark matter is, or what anything is. You can define it by what it does, and then on top of that, you've just got a name. And what we've been doing is trying to figure out how dark matter behaves. Well, if you want to do that on Earth with something, then say you want to know what a couple of rocks are made out of, you pick them up and bang them together and see what bits fly off. And we've been doing the same sort of thing with dark matter, waiting for a couple of lumps of it to bash into each other. It's a bit like, as you were just saying, it's a natural experiment. It's not something that we can ever hope to achieve in, say, a particle collider, which is what we might ideally like to use on Earth, because we can't grab hold of the dark matter. But we can wait for nature to do this experiment for us. And somewhere out there, all the time there are bits of dark matter being thrown at each other, and it's just a case of spotting one and watching where the bits go.
And so you did spot some galaxies colliding with each other, so the dark matter is smashing into one another?
Yeah, exactly. We've found a very useful patch of the universe where a collision is happening at the moment. It's a fairly long way away, which is why we have to use the Hubble Space Telescope to see it. But we were lucky enough to get to control the Hubble Space Telescope for a little bit and point it in the right direction and watch what happened. And what the sort of previous theory, which says that dark matter is completely inert, it doesn't care about the rest of the universe, that would say that when you smash two lumps of dark matter at each other, they just keep on going. They don't even notice the collision. It's like a car crash where the cars just keep going straight through each other. And crucially, what we noticed is that the dark matter didn't end up in quite the same place that we thought it ought to. Now, the dark matter goes into this collision as part of a galaxy. And the galaxy has a load of stars in it, like the Milky Way and like our own sun. And it also has a load of this dark matter. But they're in the same place. They start off together. And whenever we look at a galaxy on its own in the middle of nowhere, the dark matter and the galaxy and the dark matter and the stars are in the same place. So they start out together. But as this particular galaxy has gone through the collision and we get a very good view of one of them, what we find is that completely unusually and as never before seen, the dark matter has not actually stayed with the stars. Now, if the stars and the dark matter just feel the same force of gravity, then if they start together, wherever they get pulled and pushed, they should follow the same trajectory and end up in the same place. That's not what we've seen in this particular collision. The dark matter has ended up in a different place to the stars. And so we suggest, this matches exactly the predictions of what we would expect to see if dark matter actually feels something of the rest of the universe around it through a force other than gravity.
Wow. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International, talking with Richard Massey, who has, using Hubble Space Telescope, said that the dark matter actually interacted a little bit in the way that it should not have. But you had a paper out in March that said maybe dark matter is actually darker than we think.
I
mean, does that just contradict
what
you just... Did you just contradict yourself? What, that one paper contradict the other?
No, they don't actually contradict each other. And I was we tried, to be honest, to get the journals to synchronize their publication schedule so that we could get the whole story out in one go, but that wasn't possible. What we actually found, though, was in this first case, we were looking at very high-speed, very quick collisions, which were over very, in cosmic terms, very quickly. And we found there that the dark matter, as far as we could measure, didn't move very much relative to the stars. So it felt very, very few forces. And we got basically an upper limit, if you like, that dark matter interacts with the world around it less than some amount. Some units, it was less than about 0.5.
So in some cases, you found it acts darker. In some cases, you found it acts lighter.
It's not as if it's some cases it's doing this and some cases it's doing that. It's all about finding these natural experiments. And the first experiment that we found it was sensitive to some things in some ways. It was quite easy to interpret, but it wasn't as sensitive as it could be. What that gave us is it said, dark matter, it interacts with the world less than this amount. Now, this week we've done another experiment, or found another experiment that was going on, which is more sensitive. And that says, on the other hand, dark matter, it interacts very, very little, but it's not zero. Well, or at least it matches the prediction that would happen if it's not zero. So, if you like, we've got one limit saying dark matter interacts less than this, and the other one saying dark matter, maybe it interacts a bit more than that. So we're sort of finally got from both sides of it, and maybe honing in on what dark matter might be and how it behaves.
Well, we hope you keep surrounding it a little bit more.
It's really exciting. For so many decades, in fact, since the 1930s, all the results we've been able to say about dark matter and all the ways in which we've been able to describe it are negative. Dark matter doesn't do this. It doesn't do that. It interacts less than this. So, personally, as a scientist, it gets a bit frustrating to keep going on not finding something that you've been spending decades looking for.
Well, good.
Finally, we're really excited to be able to say, maybe we can describe something that perhaps it can do.
Well, good luck to you. We've run out of time. We'll have you back when you get the third. Two out of three, okay?
Okay, I'll look forward to it. Thanks.
Richard Massey, an astrophysicist at the Institute for Computational Cosmology at Durham University in Durham, England. One last thing. Next Wednesday will mark the 45th Earth Day, and it's a personal note to me because I got my start in science journalism, covering the first one in 1970. Earth Day back then, it marked the start of what would be called the environmental movement, the ecology, as it was erroneously known. The problems were obvious. Rivers were on fire. Pollution turned day to night. Water was filled with noxious, toxic chemicals. You could see and smell the threats. Today, the threats elude your senses. Greenhouse gases are invisible. The sea level rise is not quite obvious. But life on Earth is slowly changing, some disappearing perhaps forever. And as they used to say on the first Earth Day, you don't know what you've got till it's gone.
Paradise, put up a parking lot with a pink hotel, a boutique, and a swinging hot spot. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paid paradise, put up a parking lot.
Well, we've got to go now. Charles Berquist is our director, senior producer Christopher Intagliata, Alexa Lim, our associate producer. SciArts producer Annie Minoff, Luke Raskin, video producer, production assistant Becky Fogel, Rich Kim, our technical director, Sarah Fishman, our engineer at the controls here of the studios of our production partners at the City University of New York. And while you're at our website, surf over there, watch the latest episode on our new series, The Macroscope. It's a survey of California's snowpack. And for all you microfauna fans out there, Citizen Science Project in LA has uncovered 30 new species of scuttlefly. See tiny mugshots, sciencewriter.com/30flies. Have a great weekend.